Our next speaker this morning is Leah Curtio is also a history student here at McEwen. She previously presented a paper in 2008 at Thompson Rivers University. Her area of interest lies in crime, fashion, and the social order of early modern English. She'll be graduating in 2010 and has plans to attend graduate studies to further her love of history. And the title of her presentation today is To All Virtuous Ladies, Honorable or Worshipful, Female Authors of the English Renaissance.
Thank you very much, everyone, for being here today. In 16th century England, a new literary culture emerged. Although the English Renaissance was relatively late compared to the Renaissance of Southern Europe, many Renaissance ideas had permeated across Europe and into England, and with them came an increased interest in the nature of man. University education saw the introduction of liberal arts into the curriculum, thus introducing ideas of what it meant to be a Renaissance man. Baldassare Castiglione emphasized key characteristics of the Renaissance man in his work, The Courtier. He praised virtues such as the ability to paint, sing, and write poetry, alongside being able to advise a prince and the ability to participate in many physical activities. However, while there was an emphasis on a complete education for men of the Renaissance, many women were still excluded from obtaining higher education. Many male Renaissance authors wrote extensively on the subject of women and where they fit into society. They saw the submission of women to their husbands, as well as chastity, as key elements of life during the Renaissance. However, while men were extolling these virtues and writing on the dangers of educating women, many women of the English Renaissance wrote their own treatises and pamphlets against the common perceptions and myths surrounding women. The purpose of this paper is to show that female writers of the English Renaissance were educated and able to participate in an expanding literary and academic culture in Renaissance England. The Renaissance saw a rise in education, which stemmed from both changes in the type of education offered and availability. A complete education in both Latin and Greek was stressed with particular emphasis on classical studies. This new education advocated the student to acquire a knowledge of all things in order to help shape an individual's humanity. Danielle Clark has argued that education was casually linked to virtue and morality while being carefully tailored to an individual's future social role. She further states that there were four key elements to the Renaissance school curriculum. First, that it was programmatic. Second, that it was explicitly functional and tied to social status and future occupation. Third, that it was almost exclusively adapted towards males, especially at the upper levels of education and society. And lastly, that it was not confined to traditional sites of learning. Education was directed towards males who would one day become the lawyers, the merchants, and government officials within the social structures of society. The education of girls was minimal at best and directed towards their future roles as wives and mothers. While most humanists admitted that women had the ability to learn, they questioned what they would do with the knowledge they acquired and whether it would interfere with their responsibilities of running the household. For women, it was more important to be chaste and virtuous than to possess a logical mind capable of constructing academic arguments. For example, Juan Luis Vives stressed that a woman's desire to learn beyond their needs was wrong, and the pursuit of further knowledge was detrimental to their reputations and that of their husbands. And while they should be educated, their education should focus on religion and remaining modest and virtuous. Furthermore, in his Instruction of a Christian Woman, he expresses the fear surrounding the education of women because an educated woman was likely to ask questions that could potentially take them out of their domestic sphere and into the more public spheres of society. This harkened back to the Aristotelian view that women were imperfect and different and should therefore be prevented from learning. This view was commonly shared by many male humanists of the 16th century. For example, both Sir Thomas More and Richard Mulcaster emphasized the education of women. The latter of the two, Mulcaster, believed that it was customary to educate girls at least at a primary level, and because they would eventually become mothers and start the early education of children, and that it would benefit society to educate them. Furthermore, like men, he asserted that the education of women should focus on their future vocation. Therefore, noble-born women should have a greater and more broad-based education. However, despite this, there were no real institutions beyond the grammar schools in which a woman could receive a higher education, as universities were closed to them. As such, the higher education of women was left to tutors hired by families. For example, Smith has stated that Sir Thomas More encouraged his daughter's pursuit of scholarship and often corresponded with their tutors, instructing them to teach his children certain lessons and skills. To educate women could cause a potential inversion of the societal hierarchy that was the foundation of early modern society, and as Clark has stated, because of this, literary rates in early modern England were relatively low into the 17th century. It has been suggested by Margaret W. Ferguson that there were varying degrees of literacy, and the ability to sign one's name did not necessarily equate the ability to read and write fully. Betty S. Trivitsky has stated that, quote, women writers were actually protesting male mistreatment of women and were re-signifying traditional constructs of woman at a time when few men depicted even exceptional situations in which some women were allowed to break silence, end quote. Fears that women could be potential intellectual equals with men prompted many male Renaissance authors to write treatises on the role of women within society, their duties and responsibilities, and what constituted proper behavior. As Clark has argued, these thoughts were centered around a debate on what was natural for a woman. Works such as Vives's Instruction of a Christian Woman and Francesco Barbaro's De Re Uxoria, or On Wifely Duties, both touched on the themes of what role women occupied within society. Barbaro's On Wifely Duties was written for Lorenzo de' Medici and his new bride, and he stresses three things that should be diligently observed by a wife to make a good marriage. First, she must love her husband. Second, she must lead a modest life. And lastly, she must be diligent in the complete care of domestic matters. The reputation of a wife was tied to the reputation of her husband. Therefore, if she lived a modest life and was a good wife, she reflected well upon the reputation of her husband. Barbaro stresses the nature of woman, and he states that, quote, nature has assigned woman the duty of bearing and rearing children, not only by necessity, but also with her singular goodwill and love, end quote. It was therefore in a woman's nature to look after the family and domestic realm. Women who stepped away from this realm of the home and family and who wrote in response to many of the accusations about women put forth by men inverted the natural order of society. It was not a woman's place to participate in the public sphere, and as Barbaro states, a woman should only go out in public with her husband and not talk to strangers, lest she compromise her reputation and that of her husband. Women writers also went against the obedience of their husbands when they spoke out against him, her husband. Barbaro states that if a husband is upset with his wife, that she should tolerate his wrath silently. However, women who wrote against the wrath of men went against the key principle of obedience. Moderation in clothing, speech, and behavior were also favored by Barbaro, who states that moderation is a noble quality. While well-spoken, many female writers of the English Renaissance, such as Jane Eyre and Rachel Spett, were considered to be unnatural and immoderate in disobeying their husbands. While Barbaro wrote on the duties and obedience of a wife to her husband, Juan Luis Vives wrote on the education of women. In The Education of a Christian Woman, Vives ties together the ideas of a woman's virtue and obedience to the ability to obtain an education, and lays the foundation for young, nobly born girls. For Vives, the education and well-being of girls had implications on the well-being of the state. Many women of the Renaissance in England and elsewhere wrote extensively on what they believed were the responsibilities of women, not just as wives and mothers, but also as human beings. An instance of this is Jane Eyre's Her Protection for Women, written in 1589 as a possible response to the book His Surfeit in Love. It has been argued by Joy Ritchie and Kate Ronald that Jane Eyre was the first woman to publish a full-length defense in English, and also the first woman to recognize the connection between language and gender. Eyre effectively takes what was commonly accepted about women, that they were malicious gossips and the originators of sin, and inverts these ideas by applying them to men. In the introduction to Her Protection for Women, Eyre addresses the health of women as well as other readers. She is accusatory of men who rally against women as gossips, and she states, quote, "Fie on the falsehood of men, whose minds go oft to maddening, and whose tongues cannot so soon be wagging, but straight who fall a-railing, Was there ever any so abused, so slandered, so railed upon, or so wickedly handled as we women? Anger argues that men are so blinded by their own brilliance and pride in their own works that they fail to see the merit in writings done by women, and that they believe that there is, quote, not one amongst us who can or dare reprove their slanders and false reproaches. Anger further argues that while men are so quick to reveal the evils of women, and drawing on arguments made by Plato, that women are the greatest helpers to men, due to the inconsistency of man's nature, the nature of women must change daily to accommodate men. True to the principles of humanist education, Jane Anger employs the use of classical, biblical, and natural references to add credence to her argument. For example, she states that what nature hath made, art cannot mar, and that which is bread and bone will not be brought out of the flesh. She further purports that women are more excellent than men because God made woman from the flesh of man. Anger is not alone in her protestations against the wrongful qualities attributed to women. Rachel Spett wrote against the multitude of body jokes and stories put forth by male authors, and in particular against Joseph Swetnam's arraignment of women in her work, A Muzzle for Melastomus. Barbara Lewalski has called Rachel Spett, quote, the first self-proclaimed and positively identified female polemicist in England, end quote. Furthermore, Spett is one of the first Western women to recognize, in print, that jokes against women are usually more than just harmless banter. The recipient of what Ritchie and Ronald term a splendid education, Spett also employs classical references to authors such as Seneca and Aristotle, and uses rhetoric and biblical knowledge to discredit Swetnam. Spett begs, quote, all women, noble and ignoble, to follow, that they be not inflamed with choler against this our enraged adversary, but patiently consider of him according to the portraiture which he hath drawn of himself, his writings being the very emblem of a monster. It is not women, argues Spett, that are inconstant, but men like Swetnam, who through their writings show the true nature of man. She also argues, also assures women, both rich and poor, learned and unlearned, with this anecdote that if the fear of God reside in their hearts, maugre all adversaries, they are highly esteemed and accounted for in the eyes of their gracious Redeemer, so that they need not fear the darts of envy or obtractators. While men viewed women as the causes of societal problems, Spett reminds women that it does not matter what men thought. It was what God thought that really mattered. Women of the English Renaissance were able to exert their agency in society by engaging in a literary culture that they had previously been excluded from. And while education was not readily available to all women, many had been included in forms of humanist education and had pursued knowledge in true Renaissance fashion. Attaining skills in rhetoric, classical philosophy, and both Greek and Latin, they were able to dispel myths purported by men that women were vain, shrewish, and inconstant in their natures. Because of their acquired knowledge, many women of the English Renaissance were able to participate in an increasingly public world and were able to dissipate many of the commonly held perceptions and myths surrounding the nature of women and their role within society.
Thank you very much, Leah. Shall we take